And welcome to Risky Business number 192. I'm Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're taking a look at Verizon Business Security Solutions' annual Data Breach Investigation Report. It's a report we take a look at every year. And we'll be joined by both Brian Sarton from the US for a global perspective on the report, and by his Australian counterpart, Mark Gowdy, who'll give us a bit of a local perspective on all things data breachy. This week's show is brought to you by NetWitness, and in this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with NetWitness's very own Sean Carpenter about using forensic approaches to do breach detection and automating that process. That's all coming up after the news. Just a bit of housekeeping now. I want to say a big thank you to Chai and the gang at Virtual Office for hosting the podcast. Thanks, guys. And I've also been asked to mention that Security B-Sides Australia is coming up. It's taking place on the Sunday before OSCET on the Gold Coast, and they've released a CFP. So if you have something fun to talk about, go forth and Google Security B-Sides Australia and find the Security B-Sides page and get in touch with the organisers. Go forth and submit. But of course, it's news time now. Time to have a look at the week's news headlines with our regular news guest, Mr. Adam Boileau. And Adam, it was only a matter of time before we were going to discover some sort of reference to so-called cyber espionage in leaked State Department cables. And apparently Reuters have been slipped one of the WikiLeaks cables, which the State Department is apparently despairing over the terabytes of US data that seems to be finding its way to China.
Yeah, well, it's a conclusion that, you know, we've all sort of reached out here in the in the private sector. You know, that does seem to be, you know, based on quantity, some, that it's likely that the Chinese government and military are, you know, up to something. But, actually hearing it or seeing it when we do eventually see the cable, actually in official sources from the U.S. government, that is an interesting sort of development. And apparently they've been doing some work on attribution because the level of specificity apparently is quite reasonable. Like, according to Reuters, they're saying that they're blaming it on the People's Liberation Army Chengdu Province First Technical Reconnaissance Bureau of the Chinese military. So, you know, I guess that does narrow it down a bit. Apparently the postcodes match up, or some other, you know, particularly sophisticated technology they're using for tracing it. But yeah, it's an interesting, kind of political aspect of what we've been seeing the technical fallout of. You can't help but think that this is going to become, you know, one of the biggest issues between, the two superpowers.
Well, and so it should. I think, though, the most awesome thing to be revealed in this cable is what the US actually named the intrusions, which were Byzantine Hades.
yeah, they do have a good line on naming things. Huh?
They do, man. Although the Grand Canyon, that's a little bit stating the obvious. But anyway. it just shows us that the State Department and, politicians, diplomats and stuff are aware of this stuff being a problem. And I guess it's a matter of time before it moves out of classified cables, shuffling in and out, and starts moving more into the public discourse to see, I always thought it was inevitable that we would see something about this stuff in WikiLeaks cables, and there it is. Moving on, though, and more news from the US here, and, word from the top, President Obama has actually called for a secure online identity system. He's recognized, apparently, that there's some problems in authenticating identities online, and wants it sorted out, stat.
Yeah, and I think, it is a reasonable sort of assertion to make. It would be nice to have some sort of, widespread federated auth system that was actually usable. But on the other hand, there are issues around, actually enrolling people in such a system in a manner that is reliable and, dealing with all the maintenance things on a large scale. And, if you try and do any sort of system like that on a, on a national sort of scale level, with millions of people enrolled, right, you just know that a government's going to screw it up, or if they hand it off to a, for people to spend government money building, right, you just know they're going to turn out something that's completely useless.
Yeah, they just go, hey, that's awesome, I got a Ferrari. Here's a big pile of shit that's not going to work.
Yeah. So, I do think it is a good idea, and I think that, it would be something useful to have. But, you look at, the example is, like, people using Facebook as a federated auth mechanism. Like, that works pretty well, but it's, that's still small dickies compared to what they're talking about.
Yeah, but, governments do things that are kind of useful, like, building airports, road networks, and rail infrastructure and stuff like that. They haven't screwed up everything, and I think the thing that makes a difference with government projects is when it becomes a priority, when it becomes a national priority, you start to see stuff moving.
Yeah, and I guess, we'll have to wait and see whether they do actually manage to pull something together and how they deal with all the, you know, all the weird edge cases that you have to worry about when you're building a system that big, you know.
Yeah.
People,
yeah, look, I doubt it's going to work as well. Anyway, moving on. We've got another case of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which does all sorts of, from what I can gather, all sorts of classified research for the United States government, has been ponzerized.
Which I guess is particularly sweet, given that they're the place that, you know, allegedly you know, did the research into SCADA hacking that led to Stuxnet. So, you know,
was that Oak Ridge? I thought it was another one.
No, I think it was Oak Ridge, wasn't it? Yes, according to this article, it said the lab, along with its sister lab, the Idaho National Lab, was recently implicated in the Stuxnet thing. So, yeah, I guess it's not the first time they've been broken into anyway. So I guess they've been on the target list for a while.
So I guess really in intelligence terms, that just means that everybody's all up in everybody else's shit.
Yes, I'd say that is probably the technical term that they would use, yes.
Yeah, so this looks like a fairly typical sort of attack, does it, from what information has been released?
And they have actually released a bit of information. They said it was a a targeted phishing attempt which directed people to an external website which used IEO Day to pop a shell, and they said they got, 500 emails delivered to 5,000 staff, and then I think 57 people clicked and 2 people got owned.
Yeah, 57 clicked. I mean, it just shows you, though. I mean, it's interesting that they've dropped this, you know, they've released information with these ratios, because so you got 5,000 workers,
yeah.
You hit 530 inboxes, and you get a 10% success rate, which really tells me that you can probably get away with hitting a lot less, and then, you know, your chances of of detection are even slimmer, you know?
Yeah, and of course, I mean, the real important takeaway is that you only need one.
Yeah, well, that's right. You know,
even if you get your click-through rate down to, 1% on your staff rate, you're still going to get owned, which is a pretty tough pill to swallow, I'm sure, for most people.
Speaking of being ponzerized, I just can't get over putting Echo on that. I have too much fun with it. There was an interesting little email that hit Full Disclosure, purportedly coming from a disgruntled former employee of some wind farm over in the United States. And, you know, basically saying, well, you shouldn't have fired me and now I've owned you and here's a bunch of screen caps of you being owned. The power company itself has come out and denied it. I got no idea if it's true or not, but it's a funny story.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, I mean, the screenshots they look somewhat legit, I guess. I mean, I've seen a few SCADA mnemonic diagrams in my time, and, you know, it doesn't look entirely out of whack. The Cisco configs look kind of plausible. I haven't really dug through, all the address ranges involved and seeing whether they are actually registered to the appropriate power company, and whether all the other bits of technical information that we can corroborate publicly, whether they do match up yet. So it's still hard to call whether it is totally legit or not. But generally these things, they the story around them may not be legit, but often the technical detail is it's probably more work to fake it than it is to just actually own it.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? It's more work to actually fabricate the evidence of having done it. And of course, the company's denied it. I mean, what else are they going to do? But it's just funny, isn't it? And as I say, it doesn't really matter whether it's true or not, because it's plausible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moving on, and Mozilla is having a look at changing the way it accepts who and who isn't a CA. I think it's kind of maybe a little bit late for that, considering they've got, everyone from VeriSign to Honest Ahmed already in their in their root trust, but apparently they're having a look at it.
Yeah, it does seem to be a bit of the old, horse already bolted, closing gate sort of thing. But I guess any improvement to the CA infrastructure is probably a good thing. And, people having their certs stop working for people who are using Firefox, maybe that will raise some questions again, about exactly the extent to which we trust the CA infrastructure as a whole. But, it is a, I don't know how they're going to, starting from this, how we're going to end up with a secure PKI or usable PKI infrastructure that actually does what we want it to.
Yeah, well, I mean, anyone who's interested can read Baseline Requirements for the Issuance and Management of Publicly Trusted Certificates. It's out there. It's published by the Certificate and Browser Forum, and it's in its final draft. So according to this piece via ZDNet Australia, written by our good friend Darren Pawley, who incidentally has just picked up the job as the editor of SC Magazine in Australia, which means, they might actually start publishing some news. But yeah, apparently from June 30, Mozilla Software is not going to accept certificates signed with MD5. Like, yeah, way to catch up to like what you should have been doing a few years ago, guys. But yeah, I doubt this is going to make a massive difference to trust on the web. And if anyone missed the interview that ran on Risky Business with between myself and Peter Gutman talking about problems associated with SSL, You know, I'd really, if you haven't listened to it, I'd just say go have a listen to that interview, because it was a good one. He really did nail it, I thought.
Yeah, well, Peter's always good like that. Worst case, you can always go Google Honest Ahmed and, you know, take it from there.
Yeah, well, if no one's seen it yet, go check out Honest Ahmed. He's trying to get himself a gig as a CA and register his cousins Mehmet and I can't remember the other one. The other name is RAs, but... he sells used cars and certificates. It's quite funny stuff. Moving on, just very quickly, just thought it rated a mention. Facebook is introducing some form of two-factor authentication, much in the classic style of Google.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's a great move. It's something that, you know, will drive the uptake of two-factor auth and the expectations for two-factor auth, you know, amongst a fairly non-technical and very large user base. I think that's a good thing.
Yep. Okay. Moving on, Vericode has released its State of Software Security report. And as it turns out, most software is pretty shit.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're all particularly shocked about this finding.
Yeah, so they had a look at 5,000 applications over 18 months, and they found 58% of them had unacceptable security quality when initially scanned by Vericode's, you know, fancy scanning platform. And what's funnier than that, 8 out of 10 web apps actually fail against the OWASP top 10. Ruh-roh.
Yeah, that's pretty tragic, you have to admit. Another interesting stat that I read out of that report was that something like, 78% of security products failed first time around versus 58% overall. He's like, hello, CA, are you listening?
Oh, here's something interesting that falls into the category of government doing something useful. The Defence Signals Directorate here in Australia, which I guess is the equivalent agency to the NSA in the US, has actually issued this big guide. It's like a checklist for government when they're thinking about using some sort of cloud service. Brett Winiford from Haymarket wrote this story up. It's a good piece, and it looks like an even better checklist.
Yeah, I read through the article and also the source document itself, and it is a pretty good discussion of the overall risks of cloud services, and specifically the sort of things that government departments have to worry about when using the cloud. And the checklist is actually quite comprehensive. It's so comprehensive that it makes me wonder whether any non-cloud infrastructure would be able to meet all the things in their checklist, or at least provide some degree of assurance.
But I think I don't think any cloud service is going to pass this checklist, too.
No, I would say hell no.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the point. I think they've issued guidance to just basically say, well, if you find a service that ticks all these boxes, you can go for it. Otherwise, you don't, which means,
Yeah, but no, it's a great document. And, even if you're not a government organization, I think, it would be a very useful thing to read for next time that your CTO is trying to talk you into doing something cloudy.
Yeah, I mean, things off the checklist are like, I can use my existing tools to monitor my use of the vendor's services. The vendor has a secure gateway environment. The vendor's gateway is certified by an authoritative third party. The vendor provides a suitable email content filtering capability. I guess that's in the case of outsourced email. The vendor supports the identity and access management system that I use. Blah, 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 blah.
The vendor will notify me of security incidents. I will receive adequate compensation for a security breach caused by the vendor.
Oh, God, they're comedians as well.
Yeah.
But anyone who's interested in reading that guide, the source document is called cloud_computing_security_considerations.pdf. No text version? Yeah, so if you search for Cloud Computing Security Considerations DSD, I'm sure you will be able to find it. Now, moving quickly into this next piece that comes to us from Korea. Holy moly, South Korea's largest banking network is an absolute mess after a bunch of guys basically just... hacked in and ran through the place like bulls in a china shop.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. And I know there's a bunch of people who listen to Risky Biz who are, in the financial services industry and banks and things. Man, this is the story you need to be talking to your bosses about. Like, this is pretty brutal. Apparently, the story goes that they, the bank itself, which is something like 5,000 branches, a really, fairly large bank, they appear to have someone, burn down one of their core boxes. There was, some kind of intrusion. Presumably some manner of crime was done, and then logs and all the other data were deleted. And it appears, according to the reports, that the attack actually originated from the laptop of an IBM contractor who was doing work for them. And it appears to be done in corroboration with some manner of, of some disgruntled insiders, one presumes. And they are holding some of the security staff are not allowed to travel whilst they're investigating. And you know, the implication seems to be that people who had very high level, one of the reports had a quote, super root, unquote, access by virtue of being security staff, which is, that's a particularly sore point for a lot of people, right? I mean, the fact that there are a few very highly highly privileged people who are in a position to do something really bad. And in this case, you know, they're talking something like, 300,000 customers have filed complaints. And they're talking class action suits. They've got, 5 million credit card customers who are not able to be accurately billed for the last few days. And they're still having problems with processing online transactions and things after, 5 or 6 days have passed. So this is a very, very serious incident for them. And, the C-star-O's, they're going to go down for it.
Yeah, look, this is one to follow, and I'm surprised it hasn't got more coverage. I suppose it's just because it's happened in Korea. I mean, this is an Australian Associated Press story that we're discussing here. So, you know, let's just see if more news leaks out about this, because it's one of those things that we've always theorized about is, like, how much damage could you do, and what sort of damage does that do to a nation? How much damage is inflicted on the economy when you experience such a massive disruption to banking services? And I'll tell you what, here in Australia, we keep getting these... You know, the banks are always putting them down to processing errors, but we've had instances where the ATM network's going down, where people's wage checks aren't being processed, and it's taking them a long time to sort it out. And at some point, you got to think, are we sure that this is a benign failure?
Well, exactly, yeah. And, you know, this one appears to be not very subtle. And, you know, we can't even really at this stage call whether this was absolutely, entirely deliberate, or whether there was some element of, accident or fail internal procedures or whatever. But yeah, even if it was a slightly more subtle attack, we really would be left wondering. And, people are going to assume that it's just, computers doing dumb things, when, maybe somewhere Honest Ahmed, has a new venture capital fund.
Just very quickly, and this is one that the listeners might want to go and investigate on their own. We're way behind on time this week because there's so much news to report. But apparently cops in Michigan have been using a forensics toolkit to snag data off people's phones without warrants. They're just give me a phone, plugging it in and grabbing all their messages, pictures, everything. This is freaky deaky. And not surprisingly, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, is jumping up and down about it, but heavy stuff.
Yeah, indeed. This company Cellbrite apparently make some kind of forensics device that will plug into all the common cell phones and slurp all the data off relatively quickly, with a user interface that even a traffic cop can drive. And so, yeah, that is kind of creepy, especially when they're doing it, on a, without any other, warrants or any other oversight.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to last. I think definitions of search and seizure are going to be updated, but I just thought it was an interesting piece. As I say, if you're interested, go have a Google around and I'm sure you'll find it. Very quick bit of news here, and Cubes OS, which has been around as an alpha for a while. This is the Linux distribution being put together by the folks at Invisible Things Labs, headed by Joanna Rutkowska. They have released a beta version for our American listeners, of the Cubes OS, which is all sort of hypervisor-based and uses hypervisors to sort of split the OS and applications up and do separation and, stop the whole thing from being subverted if you happen to get your browser owned.
Yeah, I mean, Cubes is a pretty cool concept, and it provides, I suppose its main aim is to provide a fairly usable environment to allow you to segregate up, your things by task. And that's something a lot of us do already. So providing an interface that makes that more usable, more efficient, is something that, a lot of people who are listening to this probably will find interesting. And, yeah, go and have a play with it. The alpha was still quite usable. It is just Fedora underneath with some extra glue and stuff. So, give it a try.
Yeah, it's spelled Q-U-B-E-S, if anyone is interested in having a look at that. And, it's funny that you say a lot of us are already doing that, because I think your actual mental state of paranoia can be measured by the number of hypervisors you're actually running.
Yeah, exactly.
Your number of virtualized OSs that you're running. And we're going to end this week, Adam, with what is strictly speaking not a security story, but it's an absolutely fascinating yarn that you sent to me earlier this week. This version of the report, it's carried on a number of outlets, but this is this version that we're discussing came to us via the Register.
Yeah, so during the conflict in Libya that's been going on lately, apparently the rebel side managed to set up a cell network using, you know, pretty much half the country's cell towers that they stole off one of the other cellcos. In this case, one that's actually run by Colonel Gaddafi's son. So it appears like a bunch of network engineers.
I don't think he actually runs it, man. I think he just cashes the checks. Well, but anyway.
Yeah, he's got the spectrum allocation, right? That's all that matters.
Yeah.
But anyway, so a bunch of network engineers from the cellco on the rebel side apparently unplugged the links that tie their half the network back to the, you know, headquarters in Tripoli, and they got themselves some, you know, new mobile switching core equipment with a bit of fundraising, plugged it in, jacked all the registration records out of the existing cell network and imported them across into their new cell network, and, you know, stood up a cell network that's free for domestic calls, and glued it into a VoIP service out via a satellite link, and, you know, now they're running you know, a free rebel operated cell net.
That's awesome. Pirate GSM.
Well, exactly, yeah. And this is, you know, it's very cool, and, you know, it's very, very modern, very hip. You know, and, you know, communication being so important in, you know, in modern society, especially in a conflict. You know, it's really cool to see people, you know, network engineers and technical staff, you know, using their knowledge, you know, for something that really does impact the wider community.
Yeah, no, it's a great story, and if you are, if there are any comms geeks out there, you might really want to check it out if you haven't heard of it already. Adam, that's it for the week's news, mate. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Not a problem. It's certainly been a full week this week.
Yeah.
Yes.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Up next, it's time for our annual look at the Verizon Business Security Solutions Data Breach Investigation Report, or DBIR. The report is basically a summary of Verizon's forensics investigation caseload, combined in recent years at least with the US Secret Services caseload. They work on the report together. The idea is that by looking at all of these compromises after the fact, some lessons can be gleaned, like, you know, how are people getting owned, what are attackers after, and what sort of countermeasures can we put in to defeat the most common sorts of attacks. Brian Sarton joined me by phone to discuss the DBIR. One of the big surprises this year is the number of compromised personal records, like credit card numbers and so on, has actually hit more or less an all-time low if you compare it to the numbers of years before, 4 million records compared to like hundreds of millions in previous years. But as you'll hear, Brian says that's easily explained. There's so much credit card information floating around in the underground that no one can really be bothered stealing anymore.
Some of what you're seeing may in fact be a short-term side effect, I think, driven by the black market underground. Eventually, all of that, especially the credit card numbers, Magstripe records that were stolen in late 2008, you know, there's a huge surplus still in the information black market. At some point very soon, all that data is going to expire. Those accounts are going to expire, and at that point, the value of those records will probably not only meet their previous $9 to $14 each, but probably surpass that, which means those crimes will be back on the menu.
All right. Well, why don't we just start? Why don't we just go back for a second and have a look at an overview of the report? What do you think of the, say, the, you know, the three or four most interesting things about this year's report?
I'd say the number one most interesting thing is, I hope the readers, when they see it, the first thing that jumps out at them is that, in fact, when you take raw data from real world electronic crimes, things that actually affect public and private sector organizations around the globe, in fact, real-world crime is considerably different than what you'd anticipate. It's considerably different than what people read, and that's worldwide. All this notion of attacks against critical infrastructure and Stuxnet and advanced persistent threats and things like that sound great. They make great storylines, but in fact, well, there may be threats there, but those threats are tiny. And in comparison to the perception that's generated around them, fear, uncertainty, and doubt seems to be more of a popular thing now than it's been for at least the last 15 years. What is APT exactly is perhaps the question. Zero-day vulnerabilities and zero-day exploits. If you consider malcode that we've seen 100,000 times for the last 10 years, a slightly customized version such that it doesn't get picked up on antivirus signature matching, if you consider something like that to be a zero-day exploit, then yeah, we see tons of it. If a zero-day exploit in your mind is something that no one has ever seen before, does something new and entirely different, I'd love to tell you we see it all the time. The fact of the matter is we almost never do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, people don't need to, do they? Because you can still roll it like it's, what is it Adam says? You can still roll like it's 1998 and win every time because people generally don't take much care.
In my mind, though, advanced persistent threats, I mean, what is it now that the marketers have gotten a hold of this thing and run in 10 different directions with it? In reality, it's... you know, is it a nation-state-backed thing? I would love to see any realistic proof. Why is it that almost no law enforcement agency around the globe, even those that have purview over their own critical infrastructure and their own nation-state-related attacks, actually have no evidence of that in their caseload at all?
But isn't evidence of that sort of thing hard to find?
In my mind, why is it that we have so many competitors that run around and say every investigation they have is advanced persistent threat? I would challenge anyone who claims that they can find something in a government agency or in an enterprise back office in the course of a digital forensics investigation and look at it and say, well, obviously, that's the Chinese trying to steal the Colonel's secret recipe. That something doesn't equate there.
I think they've got a few things higher up on their list than the Colonel's secret recipe, mate, to be honest. Now, one thing that was a massive standout in the report, as it was last year, is that the number one way that people seem to be getting owned these days is through stolen credentials. Do you think this really makes the case that two-factor authentication today should actually be, you know, just something that you do always?
Yeah, it should be a fait accompli. There's no question.
Yeah, okay.
All of these stolen authentication credential situations are scenarios where two-factor, especially the little access tokens, are not used. And generally speaking, they involve accounts where they're in enterprises where two-factor is mandatory. Mm-hmm. Somehow or another, there's always one or a handful of accounts that, for some strange reason, don't seem to have that two-factor token with them. And interestingly, one of the most damaging breaches on record today The point of entry actually centers around a situation where everyone in this company was saddled with PCI compliance regulations, and everyone in this entity had two-factor authentication for remote access to the company. Everyone but the chief security officer hated messing around with that little token.
And it was his account that got owned?
It was.
Oh, my Lord. You can't name who it is, can you?
Oh, certainly not. But I can't tell you that he's still the chief security officer of that company.
Now, this whole thing of internal attackers being a massive risk, the report has borne out that that is not necessarily so.
That's right. They were internal inside jobs in general were back on the menu in last year's report, made it up to almost 50%. But this year, those numbers tend to or seem to be a lot lower than we expected. You know, we figured law enforcement in particular would bring to bear a lot more insider crimes, skimming, you know, basic situations like that, tampering, secondary swipers and things like that. And in reality this year, we just didn't see those numbers at all. The bulk of what we seem to be dealing with threat-wise would be external breaches.
Yep. So, I mean, what can we learn from this year's report? I mean, already we've said that, look, two-factor is a no-brainer. You absolutely should be doing it. Given the relatively low numbers of insider intrusions and the unproven reliability of stuff like DLP technology, would you suggest that people should be prioritizing two-factor authentication over a DLP rollout?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. Now, when I say over a DLP rollout, I would have to say that the core of DLP, though, before you put something on the network that identifies traffic in motion or bits and pieces within that traffic in motion, data in transit, before you find or invest in technologies that locate sensitive bits of data inside moving traffic patterns on a network, you first have to figure out where that traffic is at rest and do it conclusively. And I feel like a broken record saying this year on year, but still, I mean, you look at the data, it's still 90%+ of all the records stolen in our study come from sources of data these people don't know they have. And and you think about it, if that's the case, 9 times out of 10, if we relied on the victim company to tell us what was and it was not in scope in our investigation, we'd be looking in the wrong place 9 times out of 10. And that underscores what a huge problem I think that organizations really have. It's reality versus perception when it comes to where they have sensitive data on their network. I don't think they agree first and foremost what are the 4 or 5 types of information that can't leak out, especially at the executive level, you know, what can end up in the wrong hands, but then they don't know where it is. It's not 3 or 4 storage points like they expect, like they have documented. It's 30 or 40, and it's always these other sources where it comes from.
How do you wind up with those extra sources? Are you talking about things like backups and sort of, you know, horrible swap files full of full of information that shouldn't be in there because they're passing, you know, data is passing through some sort of processing terminal. What, how do people wind up with those extra sources?
Yeah, sometimes it's more obvious even than it's something like a swap file, right? In this case, you're talking about either transaction logs or application logs that are clearly tracking things they shouldn't, inbound storage, transfer, things like that of records. But the most common one is developers doing their development work with live data. Mm-hmm. Now suddenly all that sensitive stuff is just not on the database. They have another copy of the live database in staging, and that live database is nowhere near as protected because supposedly it has test data on it. No, it has a full copy of live data circa last March.
Well, your DLP ain't going to do much to fix that, but neither is your two-factor auth, is it?
Oh, that's right. And then what happens when the developers have bits and pieces or fragments of that that data quantity on their systems? You have 15 of them. They all go home at the end of the night and at the end of the day, and their kids use their laptops to surf the internet and download music and things like that.
Yeah, and then they wind up with malware on them, and then
then they're in our report. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of how that happens. I mean, but what do we really do to prevent that from happening? I mean, how is it just good policy on behalf of the security team?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. It's not just policy. It's the process. It's the people, and in some cases, the technology. I don't understand why, and I mean this, Patrick. Why is it so difficult for all organizations, from the biggest to the very smallest around the globe, to figure out that answer? If we are all there, all of us information security people are all there to protect the information, then why is it these people can't find the information? How do you protect it if you don't know where it is? But why is it that my group, in the beginning of every big investigation, the most tedious part is figuring out conclusively where all that data is? And forever we're showing, you know, the customer a depiction of their information flow patterns pertaining to whatever it is we're investigating, and they're stymied when they see, again, the difference between reality and perception. Why is it that it's so easy for us to do, but other people can't? We're using conventional tools to do it.
Mm-hmm. What sort of conventional tools do you use to do that sort of mapping and find
digital forensics tools, the most basic example. When we open up a computer system, for example, looking at memory, looking at unallocated space, do you see patterns that applications on that system have repositories of data in static form, either in compressed files, in complex files, information stores, and things like that? Or do you see examples within unallocated space that an application uses or processes this data but doesn't write it to the disk, i.e., like on the Windows system, you have the page file expanding and contracting over time?
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant about the old swap file issue.
Yeah, exactly. It leaves old paged information right there on the disk still that can be collected.
What was the typical sort of investigation that you guys did? Because we're down from like 200 million records being breached in 1 year, and this report, it's like, what, less than 4 million?
Mm.
So what is it that people are after? What does a typical call out look like for you guys?
Well, the typical breach is an organization. You might have seen the median size of organization that we saw compromised. All three of the parties involved, Dutch High Tech Crime, Secret Service, and us, showed they were organizations between 1 and 100 employees, so pretty small. Hotels would be a perfect example. Hotels, for some reason, we saw way too much demand for emergency response from hotels and resorts last year. And you think, what is it that's getting hit in those hotels? It's by and large the reservation system, and a distant, very distant second would be point of sale systems and gift shops and stores and things on the premises. But a reservation system may have magstripe records or other card-related data, but it also has PII pertaining to the individual customer. So you have both consumer record and identity data for the same individual. Better set the stage for identity fraud. Generally speaking, right now, we are seeing that criminals in the environment where people are getting the message that especially payment cards and the conventional consumer records like ACH, check data, credit cards, debit cards, where those are more frequently protected because obligations are forced to protect it and they go through audits once a year. In that kind of an environment, what you see is that criminals tend to be after the best of the rest. They get in, they can't get at the payment card data, even in situations where they know it's there, and they get their hands on anything else they could possibly convert into cash.
And that could be something as simple as just identifiable information.
Yeah, it could be a bunch of spreadsheets. It could be their company's HR data. All data types that would be ancillary at best in investigations in the past. Well, now frequently the investigations we're dealing with, it's 4,000 spreadsheets. It's 1,000 emails. It's that some of which have sensitive data on them. A lot of the cases we're dealing with now actually have different, what in the past we wouldn't even consider to be necessarily sensitive data. Now all of a sudden, other types of data are taking the center stage. That's why one of the reasons why the record population is low. Not the main reason, of course.
Another thing that I noticed in the report is there seem to be certain common themes among many of the attacks, which you guys say could indicate a pretty high level of organization in the underground and maybe even a tight control of the underground among perhaps a few syndicates. Have I interpreted that correctly?
What we're dealing with now, I have to say, yes, you do see some semblances that there are distinct capabilities in organization, yet when you look at the tools, again, we still have a continuance of the concept that electronic crimes are commoditizing. And that boring part of my job, I think you and I have talked about in the past, that we never see anything new and different. It's getting worse. Things aren't getting more sophisticated. They're getting simpler. What we're dealing with is more cracker than hacker, if that makes sense.
Yeah, look, it does make sense. It's like someone who knows how to implement some sort of attack toolkit against a POS system that some dude's figured out.
Yeah, when it comes to picking targets, these crackers, they don't go after elephants like we've seen in the past. The big financial companies, the big retailers, I think criminals have gotten the message. Now they realize if I hack into a great big company, and that initial point of entry in particular, exploiting vulnerabilities is a messy thing. And it leaves any manner of thousands of different types of footprints behind. And we've gotten, after all these years, Patrick, pretty darn good at identifying those. And those things lead to arrest and prosecution. So when it comes to picking targets, they go after rabbits, not elephants.
Yeah, because those guys aren't going to know they got popped and they can't afford to hire you guys anyway.
That's right. As long as law enforcement or ourselves can't tie multiple data breaches together and tie that against a single perpetrator, well, the damages are so low and the breaches all cross geographic jurisdictions, it becomes, almost impossible. We don't have enough tackling fuel to pursue support from foreign nations, particularly those with no extradition treaty.
So it really seems that what we've got now is an underground who are attacking opportunistic targets with poorer security. They're trying to grab financial information. Still, that's number one on their list. But if they can't do that, they'll grab personally identifiable information that they can then use to do follow-up scams directly on consumers, whether or not that's spamming them, selling them rogue AV, that sort of stuff. Am I right?
That's right. That's right.
All right.
Criminals are after data they convert into cash. In the absence of the conventional data types, they will seemingly get their hands on whatever they can. But I like your term opportunistic earlier, because that actually goes back, right now, more often than not, the crimes we are seeing, the points of entry, very similar to the use of stolen authentication credentials, well, those are perfectly clean points of entry because, security countermeasures are designed to look for unauthorized access and suspicious activity and security breach. There's nothing security breach about a legitimate user logging on with their own credentials, or so it seems.
So it's two-factor is the three key points from this report.
That's one of them. There's also a section on mobile devices. If you go back, 2-3 years ago, we saw almost no cases where end-user mobile devices were in scope, and certainly almost no records that were stolen by virtue of that avenue. Now, last year, in last year's case data, I think mobile devices were in scope to about 35 or 36% of cases, but it was still only 2% of the 900-plus million records stolen. Now, all of a sudden this year, that's different. Mainly, these are insiders who are issued these devices, who are using them as a vehicle to bypass security controls on the network and on the desktop.
What do you mean by bypassing security controls, like using personal email accounts, things like that?
Personal mail accounts on business time. We're seeing especially the usage of these devices for large-scale storage. And I'd say that's probably the number one, the usage of them as a conduit.
Okay, right. So they're using their Hotmail and their Gmail from their iPad and mailing stuff out and bypassing the sort of sanctioned servers.
Yeah, imagine what it's going to look like in 2 or 3 years when most of the data that's stolen comes from these devices. That's 180 degrees from where it is today.
Mate, it's not all terrible news, is it? I understand that log correlation technology and just general logging setups are actually getting a lot more effective at spotting weird behavior.
That's right. Well, they certainly are. They're getting a lot more effective in tools to automate the ability to find needles in a haystack and weed through some of the false positives. Certainly those are getting better. At the end of the day, if you know what electronic crimes actually look like, and a lot of the, you know, not necessarily all this stuff you read about, but real electronic crimes, like what we're talking about with the perspective of these two law enforcement entities, Verizon, is, well, in fact, it is very repetitive, and there's probably only the, you know, it's the same 8 or 9 crimes over and over again. And if that's the case, if repetition is a function, then if you look at the pre-attack research, you look at initial points of entry, you look at data exfiltration in particular, there are concise patterns that we see over and over again. The point there being, those patterns aren't simple point-in-time things like a failed login, or they're not a little type of event that IDS would pick up on and send an alert. They're more like combinations of 16 or 18 different events within a specified amount of time. In other words, if you know what crimes look like in the real world, you can spend a little bit of effort just to look for crimes in motion, as opposed to looking for suspicious activity.
So you think security information event management consoles and log aggregators and stuff are actually starting to mature and become quite useful?
Well, I do see that those products are getting better, but I'm not seeing a lot of canned solutions that have a true capability to pick up crimes in motion. And in the companies that are doing it well, I would say by and large are doing it with their NetFlows. I'm not really seeing much in terms of vendor solutions on this, but companies that are leveraging their own tools, and especially their NetFlows, independent of security devices, you know, to look at raw patterns of events with inside NetFlows, especially those occurring outside their perimeter network. Instead of looking at one-time events, why don't you look at the combinations of, like I said, 18, 19, 40 of those events back-to-back that obviously signify a crime that we've all seen hundreds of times over again.
Stateful logging.
That's right.
All right, Brian Sutton, thank you so much for joining us again this year to discuss Verizon's data breach investigation report.
Good to speak to you again, Patrick.
Brian Sutton walking us through this year's Verizon Business Security Solutions data breach investigation report there. Now we're going to check in with Brian's Australian counterpart, Mr. Mark Gowdy, to see if anything popped out locally. And as it happens, it did. As he explains it, Australian point-of-sale systems were getting off light in past years, and for whatever reasons, POS systems in Australia are now being actively targeted, as Mark explains.
What we're seeing in Australia now, Patrick, and around the region in general, is that these attacks that we're pretty much getting a free pass on, and the attacks weren't coming to our particular regions, we're seeing those attacks coming to our shores as well. A reason why we might have been getting the free pass in the past was because we were using perhaps different versions of software than was generally used in the US and Europe. So perhaps some of the regionalization and somewhat, you know, almost a bit of security by obscurity was protecting us. Probably the main commonality we're seeing between many of the compromises, Patrick, is not so much the POS vendor, not the particular type of retailer or merchant. It's more about their IP address, and which particular IP range they're in. And these attackers are scanning for vulnerabilities in an IP range. Who knows if these guys even know that they've hit Australia or New Zealand or Japan or Singapore.
Mark Gowdy from Verizon Business Security Solutions there with a quick Aussie update on this year's data breach investigation report. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. As regular listeners know, this podcast is only made possible via the support of our sponsors, and that's why we have the sponsor interview in the end of the show. And this week's show is brought to you by NetWitness. They make all sorts of very groovy kit that is most useful, currently at least, for detecting compromised machines on your network. It was NetWitness kit that RSA used to detect the alleged APT attack that resulted in the theft of their something. They won't tell us exactly what. Jerks. But RSA must have really liked the NetWitness equipment because they went on and acquired the company, NetWitness. So EMC has acquired NetWitness and it's being folded in as a division of RSA Security, which is, you know, pretty impressive for a new vendor. I think NetWitness has been around since about 2006, 2007 or something like that. Anyway, one of the guys who works at NetWitness is Sean Carpenter. And if that name rings a bell, don't be surprised. Sean is probably best known as the Sandia Labs whistleblower. He was the guy who detected half of China crawling around in Sandia's computer network. Sandia, of course, do nuclear research in the US, if you can guess what that means. Now, his bosses didn't want anyone to really know that there'd been this breach, but Sean took it to the feds anyway, and he wound up getting the sack. And if you're interested in his story, you can Google for Titan Rain. That story does have a happy ending, though. He actually wound up suing for unfair dismissal and walked away with something like $1 gazillion. I think it was $4.7 million. So I'm kind of wishing someone would sack me unfairly. But it's too bad because I work for myself. You're fired, Gray. You're useless. No, that doesn't work. Anywho, the point is, Sean knows a thing or two about sophisticated adversaries. And these days, he works for NetWitness, a company that makes kit that's supposed to detect compromise. Now, while post-compromise detection has been around for a while, it seems like it's being embraced by a whole bunch of new vendors and their clients. So I started off by asking Sean if this new approach and the success of vendors like NetWitness is a market acknowledgement that everyone actually gets owned at some point.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, if you have computers connected to the internet in some way, I don't care what organization you are, private sector, government, you're going to get had. If it's either some drive-by download sort of thing or a targeted attack. And it's just absolutely essential to get that system off the network or systems off the network because you're going to lose machines no matter what. I don't care what kind of technology you have. And I completely agree with that.
Yeah, there used to be this vendor philosophy, which is, look, we're going to throw all of our R&D, and it is kind of an old-fashioned mentality that probably comes more from the AV companies than quote-unquote security vendors. But they seem to be thinking, look, we'll throw all of our R&D into prevention, so we're going to catch stuff before it happens. And then, you know what? Their stuff didn't really work that well, and they would have seen developing solutions to detect a compromise which would have resulted from a failure in their existing products as almost like, damaging to their marketing or damaging to the perception of their products in the market. I mean, is that one of the reasons you think post-compromise technologies haven't been very popular until now?
Well, companies with, a lot of resources behind them and traditional thinking has been that, hey, we have this particular suite of AV products and, we've paid extra for all these plugins and we must be okay. But time and time again with some of these incident response engagements, pretty much all of them that involve sophisticated threats, you get the question, well, I have this particular product, why didn't it alert? And they don't. The fact of the matter is, for some of these sophisticated intrusions, these people have banks of all of the antivirus products, and they run this malware through there with the most recent antivirus definitions, and make sure it isn't detected. So it's going to catch some of these things, of course, but it shouldn't be depended on. It should be part of your layered defense.
That's what I was kind of getting at with this whole traditional mentality. It's almost not the fault of the organizations that, really should have probably been developing this stuff who haven't. It's the fault also of the customers who say, well, big vendor X here says, look, they're gonna block all of these attacks. And you guys are telling me that you're just going to tell me when I've already been owned. I don't want to be owned, so I'm going to buy their stuff. I mean, that seems to have been the prevailing mentality. I guess what I'm getting at now is that among many organizations, they're starting to recognize that their layered defenses aren't good enough and they really need something in there that is useful in detecting a sort of last tripwire just so they can go, oh,
Completely. And you also need some visibility to do damage assessment, particularly with these sophisticated threats. All these people need is a foothold. And the vast majority of the time with sophisticated threats, I sort of dislike the marketing term APT, but call it what you will.
Well, your parent company certainly seems to appreciate that term, Sean.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm not a marketing guy, but I like to be different. So let's call them like persistent external threats or pets or something.
Pets, I like it. I think that's going to be what we're going to use on we're going to use that on Risky Business from now on. They're pets.
In the vast majority of these things, AV has been basically useless. Once they get a foothold, AV, it's usually trivial to disable the antivirus. And it, particularly with the sophisticated folks, if you do not have any core visibility, and this is another thing that I hope people start paying more attention to, you know, if people are focused on the perimeter, they're all gazing out towards the perimeter and determining what shiny new product we can put in. And that's great. There's some great technologies out there, but really the interesting things are going on inside the network, particularly with the sophisticated adversaries. They get a foothold, disable AV, and try to become a compromise legitimate account and move laterally all across the network, spreading different pieces of malware that communicate using mechanisms derived from the intelligence from, you know, the previous reconnaissance that they've done. All for these very targeted attacks, they already know that the enterprise that they're targeting allows non-standard traffic over TCP 443. They know that there's no technology in place to enforce RFC compliance. So, you know, they've compiled that into several of the Trojans. Some of them beacon out once every hour. Some of them are set to, you know, I've seen them as long as 2 months, you know, just to maintain a foothold in that network. And even if you do have remediation, you know, the owners of the enterprise detect a couple of machines and remediate those machines, they're going to be back. If you don't have that core visibility, where your chances are much, much higher of seeing interesting activity that shouldn't be happening versus the noisy perimeter where you have all kinds of traffic, you're doing yourself a disservice not monitoring that core traffic.
Yeah, I'd say when one of your workstations starts end mapping your entire internal range, you know, that should probably send up a warning flag.
You'd be surprised, though, how few enterprises how few of them actually do any internal monitoring at all.
No, believe me, Sean, it would not surprise me.
But is it just a very large dependence, again, despite what you hear on panels at conferences, of this whole layered defense? And a layered defense includes paying attention to what's happening on the inside of your network, you know, versus everything being perimeter centric.
Sean, I got to ask too, did your previous experience with dealing with pets, did that sort of in some way shape your decision to go off and work for a vendor like NetWitness? Is that one of the reasons you did it? Because, I mean, I know that from what I read, you know, you could pretty much be sitting around on a very nice boat at the moment, not doing much at all. Why is it that you chose to go off and join a vendor like that?
It's a chance to innovate and hopefully to have a positive impact and come up with something that it was really missing, in my opinion, as far as the existing security products. And I know Amit and our CEO, and know that he's always up to some interesting things. So it was a chance to really, you know, try to make a difference and create something unique. I've done pretty much everything here between the incident response to what I would like to see from an analyst perspective in the interface and as far as features, and sort of closing that loop between what analysts want and development thinks that the analysts want.
You guys were doing actual incident response, where you like, you know, bums on seats going down and working on incident response. And then you also had a product team. Is that right?
Well, we really didn't have any official incident response, but it was, you know, referrals from friends of the company. And as other customers talk to their friends in the industry and say, hey, this product really made a difference, you know, you get referrals to organizations that are experiencing problems with a sophisticated threat, and inevitably we would go in and try to help them with that around our products. And you learn something new every time, and you make sure that the capabilities that aren't there, that information gets back to the development folks, and see what you can do with the product to make it more flexible and more useful.
So really, what would you describe as being the key overriding philosophy that enables good compromise detection? Is it really about chaining together multiple events, or is it about watching for certain things that are sort of very likely to indicate a compromise? I mean, if you had to sum it up as a philosophy in the discipline, you know, how would you do that?
Well, you have exploits for applications that there's new ones every day. So that's sort of the aspect that you don't really have any control over. As far as the techniques that sophisticated adversaries use, they're basically doing the same thing that they did 5 years ago.
So you're saying don't try to spot an exploit, don't try to spot zero day that you're not going to be able to identify, try to spot the technique.
Exactly. Yeah, and these folks are using some of the same tools even that they've used 5 years ago. They haven't changed. Of course, spear phishing is, you know, the most popular technique. A well-crafted spear fish is the most popular technique to get a foothold. And that goes back to, you're not going to be able to attack every possible exploit in that payload that is attached to that well-crafted spear phishing email, but you're certainly going to be able to detect with the right technology the results of that based on behavior, tools, tactics, and techniques that these folks have used in the past.
And do you think that if technologies like NetWitnesses that are designed to detect compromise rather than attack, do you think if technologies like this become more popular, that it is possible that the adversaries are going to shake it up and perhaps figure out how to be as evasive with their techniques as they are with their exploits?
Well, I think you can only shake it up so much. It doesn't matter if what type of device it is. We've got people often don't think of some of these things that they plug into their network, like multifunction devices and video conferencing systems and all of these other things. I mean, the fact of the matter is they have to communicate somehow. And that traffic has to traverse your internal infrastructure, whatever it is, and communicate with the bad guys. So if you know what you're looking for and you know how to find it and you have the technology that will give you the capability to find those things, then I think that we're still going to be able to find them. The key is to, as I'd mentioned before, to get these systems off the network before they elevate their privileges and start to spread throughout the network. It's like a cancer. You detect it and nip it in the bud as quickly as you can.
Now, I understand, Sean, that you actually have some advice out there on at least one thing that enterprises should be doing to ready themselves for post-compromise. What is it?
There's some real basic things, and one thing that I find very useful that the majority of the organizations that I visited don't have in place is something as simple as DNS blackholing and having a system already in place to be able to blackhole malicious host names and domains. There's also the concept of sinkholing, and where you basically have this infrastructure in place when you have a malicious domain that is being used for command and control. You basically have that domain resolved to a system that is on your internal network that is running TCP dump, and you actually capture those beacons that are calling home, and that's just more intelligence that you have to be able to create content, whether it be rules for your network intrusion detection system or to create signatures for some of your other network security infrastructure. Very valuable and something that you don't want to be trying to do when you're responding to an incident.
Sean Carpenter, that's all we're going to have time for, mate. Thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Got a job interview at 10 a.m. I missed the bus stop and I'm late again. I'm requesting a Groundhog Day. Turn a page over, start.
Sean Carpenter from our sponsor, NetWitness, on the line from the USA there. Thank you, Sean, and thank you, NetWitness. We've got one more show to do next week, which will probably be a short one because of the short working week next week. And the week after that, I'm taking a break to surf in South Africa for a week, which will be fun. And then I'm off to the IT Web Security Conference over there in Johannesburg. And then we're back on. But that's it for this week's show. This week's track is More Bomba. This one's called Wait Until Tomorrow. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
So I'm thinking of another plan. I take my cue from the weatherman. He says everything will be fine, but all I see is rain and no sunshine. She finally called, and the money came in.